SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, on this Monday, and Johnny D standing by. And I there's so many things, Johnny, that I could talk to you about. I almost don't know where to start. Good morning.
Morning. How did you know I was standing?
I could just tell. Yeah, you have. I could tell by the, you know, there's a little, I heard a little rustling, and it sounded like you were down in the pillbox there, down in the bunker, and. You know, kind of getting your steps in, as Tina says.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing the things you find to do with your time.
Right?
I heard you talking about it earlier, about, you know, taking care of some things that haven't been taken care of in a while. And so I suppose, you know, this is one of those make the best of a bad situation deals, if you can. And so you just kind of figure out how to get along. You don't have any choice.
You know, no, exactly.
And make something positive out of it. All those things you said you'd do if you had a little more time. Well, although, we didn't want to get the time this way, but it just kind of happened that way.
Well, and I saw it. I who did I say last week? I guess it was Anna Kendrick who said that she had to stop lying to herself about all the things she would do if she had the time. Because now we've got the time, and who's doing anything? No, I got to tell you, it took, and I knew I would get to it, but one of the things in the back of my mind, I usually save the office purge and the cleanup and the reorganization bids. I do it about twice a year, about every 6 months, and I didn't really do it over Christmas this year, so it was overdue. But not only am I going to do a purge of stuff that can be just, you know, summarily tossed, I also want to send out to people, and I know some people are not accepting mail right now, which seems a little over the top, but I literally, Johnny, have got 15 years worth of Triple Crown programs and, Breeders' Cup programs. And, you know, some Oaks Derby, Friday, Saturday Breeders' Cup. And I'm going to figure out a way to, for people that, you know, would love to have a certain year, I want to send them out to people. Cause I mean, there's, I literally have got probably 300, that's about right. I probably have about 3 to 5 copies of each year, Triple Crown programs and Breeders' Cup programs that I could share with people, and I would love to, you know, no, not, doesn't have to be a donation. Yeah, you could make a donation to some charity, and I'll send you one. I'll make a list for people to, so they could pick and choose. So that's something I'm going to do.
Well, that's a great idea, you know, because excuse me. Keeping that stuff around the house, you come to one big question: why? And it's like the other day. You know, I have my area downstairs. It's my man cave, or whatever you want to call it. We call it the dungeon. And I'm down here in the dungeon, and I pointed to some of this memorabilia that I have. And I said to my wife, I said, "You see all this stuff?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "You're going to have to get rid of all this crap when I go." that's about what it amounts to. You know, I mean, And I guess, I don't know when I hit the point that the stuff, I have to say, I was never a big souvenir saver. I was never one of those guys. I think John White, you got to talk to him about this. I think he's got the program from the first race in Santa Anita. I think he was there that day, too. But anyway, talk to Whitey because he likes to save stuff. But I guess the little stuff I did have, I came to a point and I looked at it. It was piling up, and it came to one of those cleaning days. And I said, why? What? You know, what? Yes, it's fun to look at it. It's fun to flip through it. And when I see memorabilia online, it brings back the feelings of the event and what happened that day. And all I remember is that all comes back. But I got to suggest that what's happened is we've gone to this electronic world. And now, you know, I used to keep, like, I still have the racing manuals, the American racing manuals. And,
well, those I've got.
And the Thoroughbred, you know, you have all those. And the Thoroughbred Times used to put out a, like an almanac, a yearly almanac. And I have some of those. And, you know, for reference, because if I was writing or handicapping or just wanted to look at something, you know, I would be able to just go pull it off the shelf. But now, man, a lot of that stuff, I'm not going to say all of it, but you sure can find a lot of stuff on the internet. You get lost in one of those internet. Do we have a word for it? When you go look for one thing on the internet, one detail, like who won the Travers in 1958, right? Or something, you know, and you go down a rabbit hole and you start looking.
Sword dancer.
You know, because you'll see a name or a horse. You know,
sure, of course.
So I think a lot of that stuff is online now, and the need to keep that old stuff. And you know what else disappoints me when I see something like when I'm in one of those rabbit holes and I see someone's got a program or a racing form, you know, back from, you know, a classic thoroughbred race decades ago, and you go to look at the price, and it's not really that expensive. So it's like, you know, why are you keeping this stuff? Why? And that's the answer. If you can answer it, if you can say, well, this, okay, you can keep it. But if you get to a point where you're saying, why? And then you start to think, and there's no answer. Out.
That is probably a good determination. I'm amazed myself. I mean, when I find some of these things that I'd forgotten I had, including, for instance, I've got note cards, Johnny. Brooks Brothers, those Brooks Brothers, they must be about 4x6, you know, with my name and address on them. And I have a set of them from the 1990 Breeders' Cup. And what each one is my notations going into the day and you know, my priority list on the wagers and who I liked, you know, kind of going in and you know, just horses that are must use, might use, you know, backup types, ABC, you know, ABCX, if you want to use the Steve Crist method. And I come across them, you know, every time I do one of these clean, and I can't bring myself to throw them away. And it's part because, you know, it's got, you know, my address from, you know, when I lived in Manhattan and 211 East 35th Street, just below Second Avenue. And I don't know. I there's a certain connection to you know, that the time I was spending Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you know, handicapping and just, you know, knowing what I did and so forth. I don't know. I find it very hard. And it drives Tina nuts. I mean, I found the program. Today I found the program from the 1990 Breeders' Cup, and I saved the tickets that I didn't cash. I've got the tickets, Johnny.
I think they're dead now.
They're 30 years old. They're married and have children already.
I think you're stuck with those tickets. it's funny because when I think, talk about these rabbit holes, I went down one the other day, and I think some of this stuff, like you're talking about, it's important to us just because when we look at it, and as I kind of touched on before, you bring back memories, and you feel, you get emotions. You really do. Your brain revisits sights, sounds, and you remember what happened. That happened for me, interestingly enough, the other day. I went down a rabbit hole on the internet, and I found, like, baseball cards. Like, I was looking at, you know, how much are baseball cards? What are they, you know? And I started to look up, or bumped into, I guess I should. At first, I bumped into them, then I went and looked, you know, more deeply. But when I run into these baseball cards of Philadelphia Phillies players from the 60s, and, I mean, I want to tell you, I could almost smell Connie Mack Stadium. I mean, it brings back these, and I remembered my grandfather taking me to the games, and I remembered this player in right field or this player at second base, or then I remember what the ballpark looked like. And you know, all these feelings came flooding back. And I really think that that's the value of keeping these kinds of items, is that they really can give you. But my mother didn't keep my baseball cards. It's her fault.
Yep.
And so now I get to look at them on the internet. So they're there, you know, but I don't get to feel them and touch them, and I didn't have to. I just had to flip through them and see them. Johnny Callison and Tony Taylor and Bobby Wine and John Boozer and Art Mahaffey. You know, it's like revisiting those days was really something. Now, there is one item of memorabilia that I had that I have a tinge of regret that I don't have anymore. Just a little hint. My uncle, because I grew up, was living in Philadelphia, my uncle gave me a program, you know, like a magazine, what do they call it? They don't call it a program. I don't know. The magazine type.
The yearbook.
For the first Super Bowl.
Oh, okay, the program, yeah.
The program, yeah. And I really wish I kept that, just to flip through it and just to, you know, remember how, you know, what, like the Breeders' Cup, when these things started, I don't know how many people thought they were going to continue or that they were going to catch on or, you know. It was like, I remember being at Hollywood Park, actually working as a jockey's agent at the time, and talking with people, we wondered, they can't do this again. Where are they going to get all this money? You know, this isn't going to work. How can they do this again? $1 billion? Come on. And it caught on, and it worked. And, but, yeah, clean that stuff out, will you?
Well, and you know, the same is often said about the first Breeders' Cup, that everybody was so tickled and thought, well, this is a neat idea, but it's never going to, how are they going to duplicate this? And yet, you know, here we are, you know, 30 plus years later. Johnny, on the sports hero front, I if you were listening right out early on the opening segment, I brought up Tom Dempsey's passing to COVID and you know, certainly underlying health issues, et cetera. But boy, the outpouring yesterday for Tom Dempsey was really pronounced. People have a tremendous respect and affection for what Dempsey, because as far as I can remember, as a child, he was the first person with physical disabilities that was a professional athlete that I ever saw.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And to play, he was a kicker, but to be in a sport like football, you know, certainly anyone with a physical handicap wouldn't be able to play football. And here's a guy who, like you said, the pioneer to show that not only could he be as good, he set that record, and that was not. Of course, he played with the Eagles quite a few years too. I don't know exactly how many, but quite a few. But he set it with the New Orleans Saints, and I remember a story. Alex Karras, Detroit Lions lineman, told of the game. It was New Orleans was playing Detroit in New Orleans. There was seconds left in the game, and New Orleans was trailing by a couple of points, and Dempsey comes onto the field to try this 63-yard field goal. And Alex Karras tells the story. He said, "We were laughing. We were in the defensive huddle. We were laughing. Like, what are they kidding? You know, this is a joke." And when he kicked the ball, Alex Karras said, "I didn't have my glasses on, obviously." He said, "And I looked, and I couldn't tell. He said, I couldn't see, and I heard the crowd cheering." And I said, "He said to one of my teammates, 'He didn't make that, did he?'" And the guy said, "Yeah." So, and that record stood for so long. I looked it up and I can't remember exactly, but it was a long time. I mean, like 15 years, maybe.
I think more than that.
Maybe more. Yeah. I mean, it was a long. And then I looked it up because I was talking to my wife and I said that, look, I said, this is what he did and how amazing it was and how long it stood. I said, and the guys that tied it, they tied it at 63. There were like three
right.
guys at time at 63. I may be wrong about all this.
No, you're right. No, you're 100% right, including Tony Franklin, I think, or David Akers.
David Akers, yes. And then they broke the record at 64. Several guys broke the record. But as I'm reading the names to myself, or to my wife, I said, look at this. I said, two of these guys played for Denver. She said, well, so?
Thin air.
They're a mile high. The ball travels further. It's easier to kick for. So that's how incredible the record was. Two of these guys had to be kicking in Denver to duplicate this thing. And when you're at a game and you sit there in the stands and you look at where that ball would have had to be placed, and you look at how far that ball would have been kicked. I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind. A 63-yard field goal. And, perhaps it's handicapped, because at the time, everyone was a straight-on kicker at that time.
Except for Gogolak. Well, Pete Gogolak.
He might have been. Yeah, he might have been either. Either previous to Dempsey or, yeah.
About the same time, I think. You know, 68, and Charlie, too, both Gogolaks.
Okay, and they were freaks because nobody else kicked that way.
Right.
It was like, you know, the soccer style. Now, everybody kicked that way. But back then, Dempsey was one of the straight-on kickers. And his handicap of having basically the 4 foot, which was a half a foot, and a square-toed shoe that he wore. Now, kickers, all kickers wore square-toed cleats, wore a different kind of footwear. They wear square toes on their, so when they kick the ball, they get a flat, like a putter instead of your angled foot. You kick the ball and it'd be like a putter face. Well, Dempsey had, you know, half his foot was missing, so he had that, and it was like a sledgehammer. And he wielded that thing, and of course, he also had a deformed arm, too. But it was amazing to see him perform, and not just was he a freak that just made an unusual kick, you know, got lucky one time. He was a good kicker. He was very consistent and a good kicker.
Well, and he was a good athlete. I mean, the pictures of him that people think he was this rotund, you know, sort of like Babe Ruth at the end of his career, but he was more than that. And I remember how much you could see his glee when he would follow the ball down, and he liked to hit people. I mean, he was one of those kickers, and he was not a guy to get in front of. I mean, if Peter Charlie Gogolak became, you'd swat him away like a fly. But you weren't getting in front of Tom Dempsey. Exactly. And I just looked it up. Gogolak and Pete was older than Charlie. And he actually, I didn't realize this, but he started actually in 66. With the Bills in the AFL, and then came to the Giants a couple of years later, 68. And in fact, it says from a Wikipedia standpoint, it was actually Pete Gogolak that set off that war between the leagues. Ooh. That eventually led to the merger, because, you know, there was all kinds of raiding going on between the two. But Gogolak, you know, having gone to Colgate, knew that, you know, Gogolak had gone to Cornell, and you know, from you know, being familiar with, you know, with the record of the football programs, and he also was the first Hungarian born to play in the NFL. Pete Gogolak.
I wondered how you came up with that Gogolak.
Well, the Gogolaks popped in my head immediately.
Yeah,
I mean, when you came,
yeah,
because he started the soccer, you know,
he started soccer
style kicking.
Yep.
Without
you know
a doubt.
Who was a soccer style kicker in college? A good friend of ours, Will Schwartz.
Is that right?
Yeah. Will Schwartz. He was a kicker for MIT.
How about that? There's some titanic battles with, you know, with Amherst and with Little Sisters of the Poor of Watertown, Massachusetts. Hey now, Division, yeah. MIT,
you know,
Division IV football.
I played Division III college football. And the first day of training camp, the coach said, "Gentlemen, this is NCAA Division III football, and there is no Division IV."
technically, that's not true. There's NAIA? Is it NAIA?
We were both. We were like, yeah.
All right, Johnny, I got a tick list of stuff. We got to press forward. I got so much to discuss with you. Let's also talk about my 11 o'clock, the kickoff to a feature. See, and people may say, we discussed about throwing stuff away. Well, if I was somebody that threw things away, I would have thrown away this piece of paper that I literally wrote, made this thing. When I tell you, I'm going to guess 2006 or 7, and it was one of those winter projects that, you know, when I'm thinking about things for the show, and the concept was to have sort of an on-air reunion with the amazing lists of young handicappers, photographers, writers, you name it, the journalists that came from that amazing era of Metro Turf, Figs Form, and the Racing Times, when there was this bubbling up of all kinds of alternative sports publications. I mean, technically, the National comes from this period. But what was your experience or memories of those publications?
Well, the first one you mentioned, Metro Turf, I have no recollection of that.
Interesting.
Was that in California?
That's a good point. It may never have gotten to California. It may have been strictly a Northeast publication. That's a distinct possibility.
Yeah, so I have no knowledge of that. The second one you mentioned was
Figs Form.
Figs Form I have a vague recollection of. Again, I don't know how far that spread west. I have a vague recollection of that. But the Racing Times, I certainly do remember. That was a solid, excellent publication that, you know, really contributed a lot to the things that we enjoy today that are in the Daily Racing Form and other publications. Certainly the Racing Times and the staff at the Racing Times. If you go down that roster, there are veteran turf scribes today and handicappers. So certainly I remember the Racing Times and fond memories of it. It was a wonderful publication, really. It was for racing fans. And I don't know exactly what the death of who's the publisher? The Australian.
Yeah, it was the one that fell off the boat. Murdoch.
Murdoch. Yeah, I think that was the demise.
Rupert Murdoch. Well, there's crazy stories about that, and we'll get to that. And for those for those that don't remember the Racing Times, there's actually a crazy story with Figs Form too. That Ed Fontaine and Evan Hammonds will recount today. Here's a list. Starting obviously with Robin and Steve Crist, but the list involving of names that. Many of which got their start at the Racing Times. Jay Pridman, Jay Hovde, Dan Liebman, Karen Johnson, Irwin Cohen, Ray Pollock, T.D. Thornton, Chuck Streva, Jeff Lewis, Jackie Duke, Lynn Schneerson.
That's a pretty good batting order.
I think Brad Free as well. I don't think Brad's name's on here.
So.
Brad Free too.
So. Yep. And how many of them? Well, many of them moved on to the Racing Form.
Yes, when Chris then, the first go round to the Form, much of the staff made that transition.
They took a lot of the.
Features.
Some of the features and the editorial, that was kind of also the thing about the Racing Times, which was, it was like a, what do they call it? A broadsheet? Is that what they call it? Like a newspaper? Yeah. It was the Racing Form, the Racing Form has gone through. And the old Telegraph used to be that big kind of broadsheet thing. And, the Racing Times was like that, but it had a lot of emphasis on editorial articles and commentary, as well as adding, which I can't remember what the features all were, but they added to the past performances that were revolutionary. The Racing Times I remember very well.
Well, we're gonna have. I've wanted to do this for so long. It's so funny and perfect opportunity. And it starts today with a little bit of Figs Form and a little Metro Turf because Evan Hammonds and Ed Fontaine happen to overlap on both of those and you can't, you don't want to call them failed publications, because that that's very unfair. They were revolutionary and innovative, and many of the features, you know, Metro Turf particularly, and people won't remember, but things like closer looks in the racing form, that was introduced in Metro Turf. That those blurbs, those little, you know, three liner blurbs, closer looks, that came from Metro Turf. I'll get Litvin and Greg Gallo and the names, you know, the names here for Metro Turf: Evan Hammonds, Ed Fontaine, Dave Litvin, Greg Gallo, Patcha and Nancy, Mike Mullaney. How about that? From Gulfstream, right? Publicity guy, Dave Feldman, Tom Valedomo.
Was Dave Feldman the Chicago guy?
Yes, yes, gotta be. The names at Figs Forum included the late Neil Cook, who we understand passed away last year, Jim Kachulis, Ed Fontaine, Evan Hammonds, Bob Scalza, Steve Feldman, Kenny Peck, Keith Fustel, Doug McCoy, Carlos Spada, and Mike Martin did the photographs when they had photographs. Mick Martin, the great Mick Martin. Pretty crazy. I've also got some other miscellaneous names, too. How about Bob Weems and Izzy Brzezinski?
I didn't know him.
Bob and Pamela Sinn, S-I-N-N. I hope people find it interesting. It's something that I thought would be a very entertaining. All right, Johnny, on to the next topic. This you and I exchanged glancing blows on Saturday. That DQ at Oaklawn that was really not warranted. It was okay by me, just because I got put up, and so I'm appreciative, but I had no business getting put up.
And as you say, depends on which way the ball bounces. Sometimes you're the recipient of a DQ, and sometimes DQ goes against you, and I didn't really care that much about losing my wager. I just thought that the punishment didn't fit the crime. I don't know.
Yep.
If that makes any sense.
It does.
What's that?
Yeah, it does. No, that's the right. It was a bad call.
Yeah.
Silly call.
The winner was the original winner, number six, Winning Impression, and the original third place finisher, which was number three, General Trev. They kind of came together in the stretch. And I thought they both were kind of at fault. The six came in a little more than the three came out. But they both kind of came together, tightened it up on number five, Answer In, who was the favorite in the race, heavy favorite. And Answer In, late in the race, was forced to then check from between the two horses and probably that checking perhaps cost him fourth place. The one, Finnick the Fierce, came up the rail, actually did a little bumping of his own early in the stretch. Bumped the three pretty good early in the stretch. But he came along the rail. He was clear of the incident. Originally finished second. And he was moved up to first. What I think needed to be considered, and I wish would be considered in these decisions, is how are you going to call things? Are you going to call it by the letter of the law? Are you going to put a little thought into what happened? Are you going to analyze things a little bit? Because I think if you see something that looks like a could be a foul, how did it affect what happened? You know, and I don't know about Oak Lawn Park. Excuse me. I don't know about Oak Lawn Park stewards, but, you know, stewards have latitude to consider if an incident affected the finish. And that involves estimating how much a horse was bothered by the incident. In this case, number five, Answer In, was between horses, and he was not running.
No.
He was done.
Yep.
And what happened was, the hole was moving faster than he was. If he would have been running, he would have been up in between those two horses, and that would have been a different story if he was bumped. But he was going nowhere. He was in between horses, and the hole was moving faster than he was. And the six, the original winner, who was then disqualified to fifth, I believe, he was going to win the race. Nobody was going to beat him. The one had a perfect trip on the rail, and the six came over. And also, what else happens is the jockeys react in certain situations. If you react a little bit, you know, your chances of them taking down the winner are not great. If you react a lot and you really pull up and drop back and you're on the short price favorite, the stewards look at that and they take, you know, a bigger view of that than they would if you just checked a little bit. I thought the jock overreacted. I thought he could have pulled out of there. He didn't need to. Because sometimes, look, they're human. Docs will showboat once in a while. If they think they can move up a place and help their owner make a few more bucks, they'll take a shot. Whether this was a case of that or not, I don't know. I'm not in the jock's head. But I didn't think he needed to react that way. I wasn't on the horse, so I don't know. But he certainly reacted. It didn't look as bad as he reacted. And that cost him maybe cost him fourth place, because, as I said, he was not running at that point. So, you know, I just wish the stewards would look at the race a little more and kind of, you know, was the one going to win the race? No. The one had a perfect trip. Was the three going to win the race? No. He had his shot. He couldn't even hold second. Was the 10 going to win the race? No. Ken originally finished fourth. He was maybe going to be fifth or fourth. He's going to finish in that area. So the five, where was he going to finish? He was going to be fourth at best, maybe fifth. So to take down the winner, I didn't see it. I didn't see it. And I know it's a tough job, and these are tough calls. And again, I'm making assumptions in my analysis that could be wrong. And the stewards had to make their decision. So it's not the kind of thing where you're going to march on City Hall. It's just a case where I don't agree with the call. That's all.
Yeah, it. I agree. I mean, and that was well described too, Johnny. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where the people that bet on winning impression, they deserve to get paid, and that, you know, that's just the bottom line. This is where these get irksome. I forever have maintained I just don't I don't swing. You know, pendulum too far in either direction. I try to be very matter of fact about, you know, how the decisions come down, because if you get insane, it all it does is injure your whole enjoyment of what it's supposed to be in terms of play. You just hope that you come out ahead long term. That's all.
It's also, to bring comparison a little further out, you know, when you're watching football, you see that this pass interference thing that we got going on in football is absolutely ridiculous. There's no way to get – it may be pass interference by the letter of the law, but there was no way in hell the guy was going to catch the ball. And also, if you've got two guys pushing each other back and forth, let them play. Don't call it on one guy and not on the other guy. Let them play. If they're going to be pushing back and forth, you know, you have to use a little reasoning. Was there an advantage gained? What was, and then what was gained? You know, you have to use a little, I think. Now, look, somebody could say to me, you're wrong because you got to call it like the letter of the law. You got to follow the letter of the law. Foul is a foul is a foul. Okay, that's a different way of doing business. And if that's the way the stewards in Hot Springs do it, then they made the right call. They made the perfectly correct call. But if you're going to say, you know, let the guys play a little bit and you know, winning impressions, jockey Joe Rocco, bring him in after the race.
Exactly.
You know what? It's going to cost you 2 days or 3 days or whatever. You know, you got a little careless, Jock. You know, you tightened it up a little. You got a little careless. And because he was going to win. He didn't need to come over on the clock. And he got, I don't think he did it on purpose. He got a little careless. So, anyway, that's it. And vote for me.
Well, you got, and you're, see, this is very reasonable because I know you got taken down. And it seemed like a lot of, you know, it, you know what's funny about these calls is, you know, this was a horse who was what, 10 to 1, 11 to 1?
Nah, a little more.
12 to 1?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Hold on, I got it right here. I want to say it's in that range.
I think it was 12.
It was 12 to 1 is right. And based on tweet activity, should have been 9 to 2. and that's always the case with these. I mean, if as many people who said they got taken down, the horse would have been a $10 horse.
It was, my money was in the exotics, so that has no effect on the win price. I had a little trifecta, and I was more bothered by what I thought I saw. Than by getting taken down. You know, if it meant a lot of money to me, I would have. Look, the Kentucky Derby meant a lot of money to me. And I still don't think that was the right call. But others do. And I'm
interesting.
Okay,
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Johnny, a couple things, too. We might as well round it out to the top of the hour when Evan Hammonds is going to join us and Ed Fontaine. But tomorrow, Fonner Park with this very big Dinsdale Auto Group Pick 5 carryover. They're going to force it out. Are you going to participate?
I have to, don't I? Isn't that in my...
Yes, it's in your DNA.
Isn't that in my membership card? I have to participate in mandatory payouts. I don't think I can resist. And it's not like I've got a lot of other choices Tuesday. So yes, I will. I have not cracked the daily racing form PPs yet. I haven't dug in yet, but I will. I will take a swing because if it's a mandatory payout and there's a pot like that, yeah, I kind of have to go after it. I don't remember ever betting a race at Fonner Park. But you know what, Steve? The way I'm picking them right now, doesn't matter where I play because I don't know anything about anywhere.
Well, we're certainly going to. I was hoping to do it today, but I think we're going to maybe we'll see. Maybe we'll get a because by doing a little Monday look at the sequence. It'll get replayed tomorrow as well. I mean, certainly tomorrow we'll have somebody that maybe we'll get Nick Tamaro. We'll get Nick to maybe go through. But I also reached out to Chris Katulik to see who Chris might suggest would be an appropriate.
We want a local genius if we can get.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna find somebody. Well, you know, oh boy, if I say this, this is such an old dig at Nebraska. You know what the N stands for on the Nebraska helmets?
No.
Knowledge.
Oh man.
I'm going to defend myself by saying that's something I learned dating Janice Rovick from KU, from Kansas. Don't hold it against me. And I also used to make sales calls at Iowa State. So, you know, and Nebraska was the big bully at the time in the Big Ten. So was it the Big Ten? No, the Big Eight. The Big Eight, right? Back then, now it's like the Big 32. It's like ridiculous.
Yeah.
The craziest thing.
Yeah,
I got into that because Jan went to she went to KU, and so we used to go to Lawrence Allen Fieldhouse. You want to talk about a great place to see a college game?
Oh, I bet.
Unbelievable. The waving wheat and it's unbelievable how much fun that I got to see, you know, my Midwestern tour from living in Cincinnati, Kansas City, and then Charlotte. I got to see some things and places that, some are gone now but I saw Freedom Hall and Cincinnati Gardens, Xavier, in the gardens, in the old gardens that's been knocked down now, and Allen Fieldhouse and Charlotte. What? I saw four regional games in the first round of the NCAA in what was the show? What the hell was that called? The Charlotte Coliseum? The Charlotte? It was like a little auditorium with bleachers and I. Back when you'd pay like $12 to see four games in a stadium. It was unbelievable. I also, what year was it that I must have been living in Cincinnati and at Kentucky, there was a regional, I think I saw a regional quarter. I got to look this up the arena in Lexington, which was fairly new at the time, too. Anyway, you've got me. I'm in a very reflective mood.
Don't you have any programs from the game?
and I thank my man Art Spaulding. Art's the best. Art, the old Charlotte Coliseum, which is now called Belk Arena. And of course, Belk's the department store people, but the Charlotte Coliseum. I also saw. I saw a terrific music show in the Coliseum. I took Marianne Gardner, who was a Piedmont stewardess. Jesus.
We're getting into
here. I was going to say, Johnny, I'm in trouble. Tina's in the house too. I got to be very careful here with this.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned two ex-girlfriends on today's show. This is very dangerous where we're headed.
You're taking some people stroll down. You're running down memory lane.
Listen, I can have a marathon. I could give you if you want to. Oh.
You might get one of those masks wrapped around your head a little bit.
Well, as what about you? Are you masking it?
Funny you should ask. This morning, my wife went to the grocery store, and she was all dressed up with her with her. She had a, you know those eye covers that they give you, eye masks on the plane.
Yeah.
You put around your ears. They give you so you can sleep or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I had a couple of those from travel, and I said, here, put. So she put that around her mouth, but then she needed a scarf to, like, actually get the full coverage. And she was all dressed up and ready to go shopping today. And I said to her, I said, I looked, she was about to walk out the door. She had a hat on. She had the scarf and the mask. I said, listen, while you're out, could you do me a favor? She said, yeah, what is it? I said, would you stop by the bank and rob them? but as we're talking, I hear her upstairs. Now, of course, this is she's shopping for like 2 weeks. This is a massive trip here. And I hear her carrying in the groceries from the car. So I want to thank you because being on your show got me out of helping her. But I hear dutifully walking above my head, bringing in the groceries from the car. Now,
I love it.
It's good because I don't have to disinfect. I didn't touch the bags. I didn't touch, I don't have to do the whole thing. She's taking it very seriously. And I suggested to her, I said, if you like, I'll go to the store for you. And she looked at me and she said, you would be lost and get so upset, you wouldn't know what was going on. She said, you're not going. Because she does all the grocery shopping.
I love it. Johnny, this was tremendous fun. I appreciate it. Stay safe and stay occupied. And good luck tomorrow on the Fonner Park Force Out, the Pick 5. We'll give everybody some help on that as well. Johnny D, everybody. XB, Johnny D. We'll take a break here, top of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to start this sequence of conversations about an era of innovation when it came to racing journalism, MetroTurf, Figs Form, the Racing Times, Evan Hammonds, and then Ed Fontaine is going to join us. Stay with us. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Have you heard about the new handicapping and betting app that is sweeping the nation? It's called First Bet, and it puts the power of AI-assisted handicapping, seamless wagering, and live HD video in the palm of your hand. Thousands of bettors have already made First Bet their way to handicap, bet, and watch more than 300 of the world's top tracks. Isn't it time for you to join them? And when you give First Bet a try today, you can cash in on a huge welcome bonus. Sign up with promo code SPORTOFKINGS, all one word, and you will get $10 just for joining, as well as a 10% rebate, up to $500 for your first 30 days. With that much free cash on the line, what do you have to lose? Get started at first.com/bet. That's number1st.com/bet. And don't forget promo code SPORTOFKINGS when you sign up. And if you already have an ExpressBet account, you're way ahead of the game. Simply log into FirstBet using your username and password, and you're off to the races.
Up to 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with FirstBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust. It's not tax dollars. And by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students.